I'm delighted this evening to be introducing Sir David Waller, who I've known for a few years now, and we've been talking off and on over those years about having him come and talk to us, and finally he's arrived. So I'm really pleased he's come. David said he'll introduce himself, but let me just say before he does that he was a student at Oxford, and most recently he has been the British ambassador in Tokyo. But for the rest, David, please introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Ian, and good afternoon, everybody. I hope you can hear me, and my voice has been giving out a bit over the last few days, but I hope I'm audible. Thank you so much for coming this afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me to speak to this afternoon's seminar in the Michaelmas term season at the Nissan Institute. I know that I'm following some very distinguished speakers on a wide range of Japan-related topics. I'm going to talk for about an hour, and then I think we have half an hour of questions and a discussion, and I've called my talk this afternoon Britain and Japan Reflections on the Bilateral Relationship, which is a general title that I hope allows me to range quite widely across the full extent of UK-Japan relations, both current and historical. I was the British ambassador in Japan from July 2008 to the end of 2012. I'm a career diplomat. I joined the Foreign Office when I left Oxford 38 years ago. This period when I was ambassador was a fascinating and at times very difficult period, which included the relatively short-lived Democratic Party of Japan-led coalition government, continued stagnation in the Japanese economy following the impact of the financial collapse of 2007-2008, and of course the massive earthquake of March 2011, with the consequence of the even more devastating tsunami and continuing nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi reactor. And it was also a time in which I felt, as ambassador, that Japan had become a curiously introspective country, obsessed with its insipid economic growth and certainly compared with China's resurgence. Its poor political leadership, as you know, 6 prime ministers in 5 years, much less internationally focused than in the boom years of the 70s and 80s, or even the post-bubble years of the 1990s, with older Japanese lamenting the lack of initiative and energy of the younger generation, and everyone fixated on the looming demographic time bomb of a rapidly aging and shrinking population, not to mention the mountain of debt, 230% of GDP, albeit mostly serviced domestically, to which problems nobody seemed to have any confident solutions. So it was quite a depressing period to be in Japan. This was my first tour of duty as a diplomat there. I served in the British Embassy in the late 1970s and early 1980s as a young diplomat, and again as a counsellor in the 1990s. And I worked in various government departments in London, including the Foreign Office, on both Japan and East Asia related work at various times over the period of my career. Now I've retired from the Foreign Office, and I've become, among other things, chairman of the Japan Society of the UK, which is an organisation that supports cultural and educational contact between Britain and Japan, and which also provides a network for British and Japanese businesses where issues of mutual interest can be discussed and debated. Now, every speech I made as ambassador, and I made hundreds during the 4.5 years that I was there, of one sort or another, started with an affirmation of the strength and closeness of the bilateral UK-Japan relationship. And this one is no exception. There are many countries in the world where to be a British ambassador is a tough and difficult job, involving constant negotiations on intractable, complex problems, often in an atmosphere of extreme public hostility. None of that was true in Japan. One of the great privileges of being in Japan was that I was serving in a country where I felt there was a genuine affection for and warmth of feeling towards the UK across a very wide range of political, business and professional contacts, and where there was also a wide range of activity extending well beyond government-to-government dialogue, where this sense of continuing partnership was manifest. And this however, has not always been the case over the last 50 years. In today's talk, I want to discuss UK-Japan links, both economic and political, and set them in a brief historical context. And I also want to discuss our growing closeness in foreign policy terms in the context of Japan's regional relationships in the Pacific, particularly with China and the United States. And I'll also talk a little more impressionistically about how Britain and Japan actually see each other as countries and cultures. I've described warmth and friendship in the relationship, but I wouldn't be telling the whole truth if I didn't talk about some of the frustrations as well. I'll start by setting out some of the substance of the UK-Japan bilateral relationship, and I suspect many people, even specialists in Japan, may not appreciate quite how extensive that range of activity is. I want to look below the surface of this relationship to ask whether it accurately reflects a full mutual understanding of each other's countries. Are there disadvantages as well as advantages in a relationship marked by almost total alignment of thinking on such a wide spectrum of policy questions? And if the answer to the first question is no, and the second question is yes, what could we do about it? Let me start with a quick word on my work as ambassador and the work of the embassy more generally. We have about 130 officials in our posts in Tokyo and Osaka. Most of these are Japanese officials recruited locally. We have about 30, 35 British diplomats and other civil servants serving in our two posts in Japan. What do they do all day? Well, our main responsibility was to promote British interests in Japan. And this meant, I've jotted down 8 areas where we were concentrating: influencing the thinking of the Japanese government on the main foreign policy issues under discussion, bilaterally and in multilateral fora, particularly in the United Nations; promoting British trade with Japan and attracting Japanese investment into the UK; helping and supporting joint activity in the field of science and innovation through the links sponsored by universities and through the UK research councils; supporting links between the British armed services and the Japanese self-defence forces, often in the context of Japan's involvement in international peacekeeping and security-related activity; encouraging the Japanese government and industry to adopt a more forward-looking position in multilateral negotiations on climate change and global warming; promoting joint activity in the field of international development, where, of course, both the UK and Japan are major aid donors; promoting British arts and culture in Japan, often through the work of the British Council; and providing consular services to British people who are living in or travelling in Japan, and visa services to Japanese who want to come and study or work in the UK. It's a very wide range of activity. Some of that work is what we call representational, and involves a sort of formal, ceremonial role, making speeches, attending events designed to celebrate aspects of this work. But much of it involves very detailed negotiations with both the British and the Japanese governments, and extends well beyond the traditional contacts between foreign ministries on foreign policy that most people assume must be at the heart of an embassy's work. For example, persuading Japanese companies to come and invest in Britain was a very high priority for me. This involved understanding each firm's very specific needs, which will differ from industrial sector to sector. I used, for example, to host British health ministers with senior delegations from the NHS, whose aim was to give Japanese pharmaceutical companies a very clear sense of the pricing and regulatory structure into which they would be investing. I liaised with the British Department of Transport to pave the way for Hitachi to invest in rail development in the UK. They're building the next generation of rolling stock, which is going to be used on the newly electrified Great Western Line. When we were exploring with Japanese companies the possibility of their investing in British nuclear power in the UK, where Hitachi were also leading the way, the responsibility within the British government lay with the Department for Energy and Climate Change. In many specialist fields, Japan's views are potentially very important and influential as a major world economy, still the third largest economy in the world, second largest developed country in the world, as a member of the G8, the major industrialized countries forum, as a member of the G20, a major forum where the industrialised and developing countries address major global challenges. And for most of my first 2.5 years in Tokyo, the Japanese were also a member of the United Nations Security Council. So this means that experts from all the relevant government departments, whether it's the Treasury, Department for Business, Department for International Development, Environment and so forth, would be taking the lead on these negotiations. So this relationship covers a very, very wide spectrum. I've given prominence particularly to trade and investment because that was absolutely at the heart of my work as ambassador. So let me deal with that aspect of the relationship first. Now, it's an oversimplification for effect, but I always used to say that the embassy's relations with the major Japanese industrial companies were as if not more important than many of the relationships formed with political figures, who tended to be much more transient. The present British coalition government has given a high priority to British embassies worldwide supporting British business. But this role has been central to the British diplomatic network in Japan for the last 40 years, if not longer. British relations with Japan were restored after the Second World War very slowly. Anti-Japanese feeling remained very high in Britain, with the return of prisoners of war from the Far East and the revelations about their appalling treatment by the Imperial Japanese Army. Japan was seen in Britain as a low-cost economy, potential competitor to British industry and a source of unfair competition in the form of cheap imitation goods. When Japanese Foreign Minister Fujiyama came to Britain in 1957, this is the first visit by a Japanese Foreign Minister since the Second World War, a young Robin Day, who was then a journalist for the ITN and later a very famous British political interviewer on the BBC, challenged the minister on camera over an obvious example of industrial counterfeiting and was denounced by the Foreign Minister's interpreter for his treachery. Britain was seen by Japan as an unfriendly influence, especially on other Commonwealth countries, in the negotiations that led up to Japan's membership of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And the bilateral negotiations on a commercial treaty between Britain and Japan went on, dragged on for many, many years until they were finally concluded in 1962. The context for that was that Britain was focusing uncertainly on its developing relationship with the nascent European Economic Community, while at the same time it was seeking to sustain its special wartime relationship with the United States. And its role east of Suez, both as an imperial power and as a commercial partner, went into decline. It was not obvious in the 1960s that Britain would be effectively positioned to benefit from the economic growth that was developing in East Asia. This, of course, was driven to a large extent by the industrial resurgence of Japan in the 1960s, symbolised most dramatically by the 1964 Olympics, together with the accompanying development of Japan's national infrastructure, the opening of the bullet train network, for example, and the discovery that Japan had, behind protective barriers, turned itself into an industrial and innovative powerhouse, eloquently described by Norman McRae in his seminal Economist article of 1963, Consider Japan, which was the first major analysis of just how powerful and effective an economic force Japan was becoming. All this began to change in the 1960s as the more forward-thinking British businessmen and politicians began to discover Japan's economic recovery for themselves. The embassy, British embassy, began to develop a very clear role, well in advance of other diplomatic missions in the Foreign Office network, to help British businesses expand their activity in the growing Japanese market through a succession of high-profile trade events. The first visit by a British Prime Minister to Japan was in 1972, when Ted Heath came, and he set up, on his return to Britain, the Exports to Japan unit in what was then called the Department for Trade and Industry. At this stage, there was a strong bilateral trade imbalance in Japan's favour, fuelled, in many people's views, by Japan's undervalued currency. The work of the embassy then, and for many years, effectively until the late 1980s, was heavily concentrated on overcoming barriers to trade. These included protective tariffs, a regime of taxing imported liquor, which affected Scotch whisky particularly, that benefited indigenous Japanese product, a mass of bureaucratic regulations which held back foreign goods in many sectors, parallel imports, and as late as the end of the 1970s, when I was a young diplomat in the embassy, a mass of patent and trademark infringements. Slowly, most of these problems were resolved or effectively superseded. The terms of trade began to turn somewhat in favour of countries exporting to Japan when Japan revalued its currency following the G7 Plaza and Louvre Accords of the mid-1980s. These imbalances were, if not removed, at least they were reduced. And from the late 1980s, the British government invested a lot of resources in campaigns, starting with Opportunity Japan in 1988, to promote, in British business, a better understanding of the Japanese market and of the ways in which British companies could build long-term industrial partnerships with Japanese firms that could help develop their business in Japan. At the same time, in the embassy, we were working to attract Japanese companies to invest in the UK. Of course, there have been Japanese companies in the UK for many years, particularly since the 1970s, the early 70s, led by Sony in Bridge End in Wales, the ball bearing company NSK in County Durham. But the upsurge of investment really began in the years of the Thatcher government, when there was a concentrated effort to secure major industrial plants, particularly in the automobile industry. It's important to remember, I think, that this policy was not without controversy at the time. This was an era before what we now call globalisation. Japan was still seen more as a competitor than an industrial partner. The trades unions had been hostile to inward investment in the late 1970s. And Britain, for its part, had a very low reputation in Japan, with the numbers of days lost through strikes leading to the Japanese talking about eikokubyo, the British disease. But the decision by Nissan, it's great to be giving this talk here in the Nissan Institute, the decision by Nissan to, in 1984, to build its plant in Sunderland fundamentally changed the environment as far as investment was concerned. And literally hundreds of Japanese companies, including two other major auto manufacturers, Honda and Toyota, electronics firms, pharmaceutical companies, followed them. This has continued to the present day. It still continues even during a period of economic downturn. We now have something like 1,300 Japanese companies in the UK, employing over 130,000 people directly, hundreds of thousands more in the various supply chains. I think this has been an amazing success story for Britain and Japan working together. The experience in the other direction of British companies exporting to and investing in Japan is less striking, but we do export about £8 billion worth of goods and services every year, which makes Japan a substantial, if not now, one of the leading markets for British industry. One of the major objectives I tried to pursue as ambassador was to press for the opening of negotiations on a free trade agreement between the EU and Japan, which was a proposal advanced by the Japanese government in the wake of the failure of the Doha round of general agreement of free trade negotiations under the auspices of the WTO. Now, we did this because we saw real benefits in opening up trade further between the two major trading blocs and tackling those residual regulations in Japan, which, whether or not intended to protect Japanese industry, nevertheless have the effect of inhibiting economic activity. We pursued this objective also because we saw a danger that if we were not to respond to Japan's aspiration in this area, we might find that the substance of our relationship, Europe-Japan links, in the words of one commentator, might dwindle into indifference. That's why it's so important that the two sides decided earlier this year to open negotiations. And why, to make a separate point, the Japanese are so concerned about the current debate inside the UK on our future within the European Union, and why it would be such a catastrophic mistake, in my view, in terms of attracting Japanese and other countries' investment into the UK if there were to be any question of our coming out of Europe. But one of the paradoxes of trade and investment relations with Japan is that although there's been constant pressure on Japan to open up and liberalise trade, remove barriers and so forth, and in many respects successful pressure, the reality is that Japan remains, for reasons that are very hard to identify, a curiously difficult investment environment. And the pressure for British firms, pressure from British firms to do more in this area as a way of levering their way into the Japanese market is a bit double-edged, because those companies who are already established in Japan tend to occupy a comfortable niche within an intensely regulated and organised market, to whose customs and practices they've, on the whole, over many years, adapted themselves. And so there isn't quite that pressure from British firms on Japan to reform further that one might have expected, and certainly was the case 20, 30 years ago. In contrast to the UK, whose open-door policy has seen foreign direct investment reach almost 50% of its GDP in recent years, only a little more than 4% of the Japanese economy is accounted for by foreign investment. The Abe administration is committing itself to changing this, opening up to foreign companies, increasing the proportion of GDP that is foreign-owned. How easy is this going to prove to be? Recent years have seen some prominent foreign investors withdraw from rather than expand their presence in Japan. They've done so sometimes because the sophistication and the highly developed nature of the Japanese market has meant that their return on equity invested can't justify the level of investment required to build market share to the scale required to guarantee the necessary return to shareholders. And so the result is that outside a very small number of obvious exceptions, like Coca-Cola or Microsoft or Apple, there are very few major foreign multinational companies or world-leading brands that operate at more than a niche level in Japan. Now, the importance of trade and investment in bilateral contexts, especially in a country like Japan, which has a unique and, to a lot of foreign observers, very complex business and social culture, has given the British Embassy a very sharply defined role as both an interpreter in the broader sense and as a guide both to British business trying to sell to Japan and to those parts of the British government and local authorities and organisations seeking Japanese investment in the UK. I must have spent at least half my time as ambassador as a salesman for British industry and for Britain as a centre of Japanese investment. But trying to hold and build that relationship as effectively as I believe we have done would not have been possible without at the same time building a sense in Japan of a wider political relationship with, which is a distinct mutual political asset, which both sides should strive to support as actively as possible, which we've also done with some success over the past 30 years. So let me now turn to my second area, which is foreign policy and international relations, the broader political relationship, and in the process also talk about Japan's other international links, which is the context within which we've developed our own. If you measure the bilateral relationship in terms of bilateral contacts, regular contacts, even the extent along which we think about on similar lines on major policy issues, even I would argue in terms of broadly shared values, the United Kingdom and Japan are very well aligned. The Japanese Embassy in London point out that we vote along the same lines in the United Nations more often than to any two other countries. Our two foreign ministers meet regularly for a high-level strategic dialogue. William Hague was in Japan a couple of weeks ago for the latest round of that. There will be differences of nuance on specific dossiers, but little divergence from the basic principles of our respective approaches. Of course, while there are affinities, there will be a difference of focus in our major areas of interest. Japan's international engagement is constrained by its constitution, under which it is committed to pacifism and which limits the military role to one of self-defence. Japan has a defence and security treaty with the United States. Its diplomacy is strongly focused on the Asia-Pacific region. Its relationship with China, however difficult and strained this may have become in recent months, is crucial in economic and commercial terms. Its relationship with Korea, which is also under strain recent months, is not much less important. Japan's interest in the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is reflected in its participation in the six-party talks on North Korea. And, of course, it has itself been the victim of an egregious abuse of human rights with the kidnapping of a number of Japanese citizens in the 1970s and 80s by North Korean intelligence. Japan is developing a closer and more assertive policy of diplomacy with other maritime Southeast Asian states who share its interest in open sea lanes and, in some cases, concerns about Chinese intentions. Japan was in the vanguard of countries re-establishing links with Burma, or as the Japanese government, in contrast with the British, call it Myanmar, after the release of political prisoners and the first steps towards effective democratization there. British diplomacy, by contrast, talking in simple terms, while of course maintaining worldwide reach, tends to be more focused on Europe and the Near and Middle East. And just as we support Japan over North Korea, Japan plays a constructive but supportive role on the major Middle Eastern policy dossiers, chiefly the negotiations with Iran over its nuclear ambitions and the conflict in Syria. Japanese self-defense forces have been dispatched to United Nations peacekeeping operations in a variety of theaters over the past 21 years. They're engaged in anti-piracy operations in the Gulf of Aden. There was no military deployment in Afghanistan, but they participated in a provincial reconstruction team and have been a major aid donor, hosting the reconstruction conference in July 2012. Now, this is a political relationship, Britain and Japan, that has developed enormously over the last 30 years. When I was a young diplomat in Japan in the 1970s, we had just escaped from the era where we felt that the major objective had to be saving Japan from falling into the communist camp, but there was little sense of Japan's seeing an international role for itself outside a traditional Asian sphere of influence. I remember the ferocity with which my first ambassador in Tokyo berated the African department of the Gaimusho over their reluctance to engage in, as part of the international community, in the peace talks and support for the electoral process in what is now Zimbabwe in 1979 and 80. In 1982, the government of Prime Minister Zenko Suzuki, concerned by threats to commercial interests and Japanese communities in Latin America, took a much more equivocal position on the issue of Argentina's invasion of the Falkland Islands than the British government had hoped to see. But as Japan slowly liberalised its markets, as its profile as an industrial power growing behind protective barriers receded, the sense of Japan as a country whose international political profile should be more commensurate with its economic and commercial power increased. And so it was in that spirit that the British government in the mid to late 1980s, at the same time that it was running the business engagement campaigns that I talked about earlier, began to try and build a more strategic foreign policy relationship with Japan. And that meant closer liaison between diplomats and capitals in other countries around the world, regular exchanges of views between foreign ministry planning staffs, and high-level dialogue between ministers. Sometimes there's been a tension between the British desire to see practical outcomes from this closer contact and the Japanese tendency to see regular process as a benefit in itself. But there's no doubt that the injection of energy and effort into the relationship has borne fruit in the stronger alignment and better mutual understanding that we see today. Now, it's not easy to discuss Japan's foreign policy trajectory over this period without saying a word about the constitutional constraints. Article 9 of the Constitution, which I referred to earlier, forever renounces war as a sovereign right of the nation and the threat or use of force as means of settling international disputes. It additionally says that land, sea or air forces, as well as other war potential, will never be maintained, and that the right of belligerency of the state will not be recognised. There's been a near constant tension in Japan over the last few decades between those who wish to retain the position enshrined in the Constitution of Japan as a pacifist country and those who want to reinterpret and amend the Constitution to enable Japan to play a more assertive international role. I don't think this argument breaks down very easily into what we used to call hawks and doves. There are pacifists in Japan who wish to maintain the security treaty with the US as the guarantee of Japan's constitutional position. there are pacifists who want to reject this post-war disposition and want to see Japan play a more even-handed and proactive international role rather than simply sheltering under the US nuclear umbrella. There are constitutional reformers who seek a more assertive Japanese nationalism in the hope of recovering a greater sense of national pride. And there are internationalists who see the Constitution as a block on Japan's playing a more constructive international role, and indeed on Japan's aspirations to become a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, which we support in Britain, although it seems a very, very distant prospect at the moment. The shock of the first Gulf War in 1991, which Japan made funding commitments but came in for very strong international criticism for not committing troops and material to the international force that evicted Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, helped to create an environment in which it became easier for Japan to commit forces to United Nations peacekeeping exercises abroad. But even during my time as ambassador in Tokyo, the issue of how autonomous the self-defense forces could be, even in responding to requests from other countries or the UN for humanitarian assistance following national disasters, was acutely controversial. Much of this debate inside Japan over the past decade has been influenced by the rise of China and Japan's fluctuating relationship with its near neighbour. So I should now move to discuss that aspect of Japan's foreign policy in more detail. From the perspective of 2013, a year in which the bilateral Japan-China relationship deteriorated badly, it's hard to remember that there have been ups as well as downs in Japan-China contacts over the past 30-plus years, since the rapprochement between the two countries in the 1970s, in the wake of the shock of President Nixon's reaching out to China with very little warning to the Japanese government in 1972. Relations which had improved slowly, in the same way that Western powers had re-established contact with Beijing in the 1990s following the Tiananmen Square massacres, deteriorated during the Koizumi years following the Prime Minister's visits to the Yasukuni Shrine, but improved again under Prime Minister Abe in his first incarnation in 2006-07 and Fukuda Yasuo. I arrived as ambassador in Tokyo in 2008 following the successful Warm Spring visit to Japan by President Hu Jintao. And we had expectation of negotiations over gas resources in the East China Sea and renewed political contacts. But there is a real disconnection, I think, between the improvement of the mood music at the high political level and the man or woman in the street in Tokyo and Beijing. And this is an area of policy where a renewed sense of apparent trust at the diplomatic level is not matched in public perceptions. Opinion polls regularly show high levels of hostility and suspicion in both countries towards the other. In Japan, this is accompanied by concerns at Japan's relatively poor economic performance compared with China's growth, while at the same time recognising that China's growth contributes strongly to Japan's ability to pull itself out of its economic recession. So there's a conflict in Japanese minds about China's role. It's also been coupled with a broader international perception, crystallised most dramatically at the 2009 Copenhagen negotiations on the United Nations on climate change, that China was not prepared to be a responsible international stakeholder in areas of fundamental significance to the international community. And this all lay behind the Japanese policy towards China before 2012 of engaging while hedging. As you know, the relationship has been exacerbated by intermittent tensions over territorial disputes, which erupted last year with the aggressive and violent Chinese response to the Japanese government's nationalisation of the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea. And the result has been a serious deterioration in the relationship to its worst level since the 1970s. As a foreign observer, this can be very difficult to understand, because we say to ourselves, can the second and third largest country in the world, economically speaking, really allow their links to be so damaged by what seems an arcane dispute over some uninhabited islands? To the Chinese, there was an agreement to disagree on the ownership of this territory, which the Japanese government abrogated. to the Japanese government. Their actions were a responsible reaction to provocation by extreme Japanese nationalists, and the Chinese are behaving cynically and hypocritically in claiming that in some way this represents a rejection of the post-war peace settlement. One thing is very clear, there are no grounds for mediation here. The Japanese will not concede that there is a dispute about which to mediate, and the Chinese will not press their case in the international court. The only way forward, therefore, is to seek to develop as many bilateral lines of communication as possible to keep diplomacy, business, and other exchanges alive. This is what both sides are doing, but the dangers of inadvertent escalation or accidental clashes remain. This is all part of a background also to a change in Japan's strategic defence perspective. The old concept of Japan's primary defence needs being to prevent a land invasion from Russia in the north has been replaced by a sense that a maritime threat from China in the south is a greater concern. China indeed is specifically identified as a source of concern in the most recent Japanese Defence and Strategic Review. The theme is emerging, as I indicated earlier, of Japan as a maritime power, whose most natural links are with Southeast Asian maritime powers, a number of whom also have continuing territorial disputes with China. Prime Minister Abe has spoken of a security diamond, the US, Japan, Australia and India, aimed at safeguarding the maritime commons. He's also invited Britain and France to participate in Asia's security, as he says, to stage a comeback. The British government is exploring ways in which we might respond to that invitation, given that there are now far fewer British military assets that are deployable outside the core area of UK defence interests. But there's very great potential for closer defence cooperation, for example, in training, logistics, between our defence forces and also between our defence industries. And Prime Minister Noda and Prime Minister Cameron signed an agreement on this when David Cameron visited Japan in April 2012. At the heart of Japan's strategic worldview, and has been since the Second World War, is its relationship with the United States, enshrined since 1960 in the Security Alliance. This is enormously close, but also very, very complex. Excuse me. The US is the guarantor of stability in Northeast Asia. There are about 38,000 troops stationed in Japan. And Japan is, in one sense, a major military power, albeit with a projection of that power couched exclusively in terms of self-defence and mutual assistance within very tightly defined boundaries. But at the same time, it is that continuing alliance with and guarantee of protection from the United States that obviates the need for Japan to assume a higher degree of responsibility for its own security and for the security of the region. And in spite of Japan's very full apology for its wartime conduct, given first by Foreign Minister Kono in 1993 and then by Prime Minister Murayama in 1995, endorsed by all cabinets since 1995, for Japan to assume that higher degree of responsibility for its defence and security would present many difficulties for some of Japan's regional neighbours. That's why the US-Japan Security Alliance is so fundamental to all our security concerns. It's sometimes said that East Asia is a region that has 21st century problems to manage and 19th century diplomatic structures with which to manage them. There are the beginnings, I think, of a sort of regional architecture within which some of these difficult issues can be tackled, but there's no parallel to post-war European economic and security structures, let alone to the rapprochement between France and Germany that led to these. So without those, my personal belief is that there's no alternative to the United States discharging its responsibilities in this way. Nonetheless, the dynamic of the Japan-US relationship is complex. As a Western diplomat in Tokyo, I was always conscious of this extraordinary sense of Japanese dependence on the US. It was as if the relationship with the US was both existential, which in a political sense I suppose it was, and part of the natural order of things, an environmental factor to be taken into account automatically when evaluating its policy options. Let me give you two very trivial examples of how this manifested itself. These really are trivial, but they're telling in a way. The more trivial first. As everybody knows, the Japanese words for Britain and America are very similar. Eikoku and Beikoku. I was very amused at the number of times in which, in public fora, I was introduced either as the American ambassador or as somebody talking about American-Japanese relations, often by very experienced political and media figures. It was as if the international issue under discussion, whatever it was, the mental and vocal tag was more likely to be Beikoku Taishi, or Nichibe Kanke, than Eikoku Taishi, than Nichie Kanke. I just thought that was slightly telling. And what was also telling in my mind was how, even though as ambassador in Tokyo I was accustomed to being treated with an enormous degree of deference, because foreign ambassadors really are treated with massive deference in Japan, much more than in many other countries, I was fascinated by the intense scrutiny, front page news over an extensive period that preceded the appointment of the US ambassador following the election of President Obama in 2008. It was more akin to the appointment of a proconsul than a diplomatic representative. The danger with relationships of this kind is that they can invite resentment as well as dependency. I think it's a great tribute to the Americans, and particularly to my colleague as American ambassador during this period, John Roos, who's a very, very good colleague and a good friend, that the reputation of the US in Japan is as high as it is. And in large part, I think that's because of the extraordinary mobilization of support under the auspices of Operation Tomodachi following the terrible events of March 2011 and the earthquake and tsunami. But the reality, however, is that the relationship with the United States remains the key relationship for Japan and the prism through which successive Japanese governments see their world role, whatever tensions that may cause, for example, in Okinawa, where the majority of U.S. forces are stationed. As you will probably know, when the DPJ was elected in 2009, the immediate cause of the Kommentariat's rejection of the new political establishment was Prime Minister Hatoyama's decision to challenge the US over the long-running issue of the resiting of one of the Okinawa bases, in terms which were perceived as reducing US trust in the Japanese government's reliability as an ally, while at the same time picking a fight with the US, which the Japanese government could not win. When Hatoyama's successor but one, Yoshihiko Noda, came to power, he made a speech in which, slightly to my surprise, he invoked the importance of the UK-Japan alliance, the Nichie Dome, of 1902. He did not mean that Japan wanted or needed to return to that alliance, but what he was making, the point he was making, was that Japan is strongest when it preserves and protects its alliances. And that is why, whatever the difficulties presented by a culture of dependency, there isn't, in my view, any alternative at the moment to the current alignment of Japanese foreign policy, however much it invites criticism by external and internal observers of Japan's abasing itself as a client state of a hegemonic United States. Although contacts with the EU in the political as well as the economic sphere have intensified in recent years, there's no sense of the Europe-Japan political relationship replicating that with the United States. Japan attaches importance to having a political dialogue with the EU in step with its opening up trade and investment flows. As the EU crafts a common foreign policy position and plays an increasingly proactive international role as an institution, not just the sum of its individual members, the dialogue with Japan becomes more substantive and, I think, a bit more meaningful. But I do see some Japanese frustration with the inevitable complexity of creating a single EU position on difficult foreign policy questions, particularly China and regional East Asian and Southeast Asian security issues. Hence the desire for Japan, in Japan, to retain close bilateral links with individual EU member states and a close political dialogue with the UK and others. The Japanese government are not asking their friends to take sides in their unacknowledged but obvious dispute with China, but they do want as high a degree of understanding as they can get of their view that however much China appears a status quo power in global terms, it does not look like a status quo power in East Asia. And just as I argued earlier on that the UK would lose its position as favoured home for Japanese investment in Europe if we were to pull out of the EU, so a Brexit, as it's being described in some headquarters, the British exit from the EU, would diminish the UK in Japanese eyes as a source of potential influence within the EU. And this was an enormously important issue for us, particularly in the run-up to the opening of discussions between the EU and Japan on a free trade agreement, and all the other dossiers where the UK is in the vanguard of helping the EU to present itself to the world as a force for openness and competitiveness. Now, I've talked about trade and investment and foreign policy. We had a plethora of technical level dialogues with Japan in other areas, like innovation, where we were working with Japan and other countries to simplify and accelerate patent recognition policy so that we could bring innovations to market more quickly. Financial regulation in the wake of the Lehman shock and the financial crisis in 2008, where our central banks and financial regulation agencies talked directly to each other. I mentioned also climate change and the environment, where we were trying to get Japanese government to adopt a more, and industry too, to adopt a more forward-looking position on carbon emissions reductions in the United Nations negotiating context. In many areas, our views were either convergent or not widely divergent. Of course, there were differences. There should be differences when two countries are promoting their national interests in engaging in complex subjects. An example of this was Cancun Conference on Climate Change in 2010, when Japan adopted a position on the detail of the negotiations that we thought was going to make it harder to reach a workable consensus. But even there, I think we were arguing really about tactics rather than basic strategic objective. A previous Japanese ambassador in London, Yoshiji Nogami, used to say that the biggest problem in the relationship was that there were no problems. And this is a very serious observation. It was a joke, but it was serious too. Because absence of things to disagree about can lead to two countries taking the process of their contacts for granted, and eventually taking each other for granted too. When I first served in the British Embassy in Japan in the 1970s, as I said, we had a mass of disputes on trade and investment and economic policy. Much of the political dialogue in the 1980s and 90s was taken up with securing a higher level of acknowledgement in Japan by successive Japanese governments of their continuing obligations towards a diminishing number of former Japanese prisoners of war. But these issues have now been resolved, and so the relationship has settled into one of supportive dialogue and close economic and industrial partnership. This doesn't mean that there are no areas of disagreement. Let me mention three quite quickly. A lot of the time I was there as ambassador, together with my American, Canadian and other colleagues, I was lobbying the Japanese government to join the Hague Convention on Child Abduction, which is a legal framework within which cases of disputed child custody can be discussed and resolved, and the Japanese government has now ratified this convention. It sounds quite a technical issue, but this is an issue of quite high level of public concern among families affected. With the EU, not on this occasion the US, for obvious reasons, we were lobbying on the death penalty and arguing that Japan should abolish the death penalty. Of course, this is an issue on which there is still a very high level of support in Japan for the retention of capital punishment, but also a growing public debate calling for alternative sanctions, not, in my experience, very much welcomed by the extremely conservative Ministry of Justice. And I was also lobbying on whaling, a subject on which the British government takes a strong position in the International Whaling Commission, and which accounts for an enormously high proportion of correspondence that ministers and members of parliament receive about Japan. It's perverse to suggest that we ought to be looking for more to disagree about, and I'm not making any suggestion as silly as that. But I do think that there's a case for our continuing to work to understand each other's countries more closely. And I don't think we should feel constrained in all of that from engaging in a debate of a more philosophical and indeed political kind about the direction our two societies might take in the future. I say this because I think we can learn a lot from each other, and because the effect of the work that we've undertaken over the last 25 years has given us important stakes in each other's future development. The international context is one of rapid change. In Britain, we have a coalition government that is implementing an aggressive deficit reduction and infrastructure development programme in order to equip the country more effectively for what the Prime Minister calls a very competitive global race. At the same time, there's, I think, a reaction against recent social and economic developments manifesting itself both in a questioning of the UK's international role, and in some quarters, of course, this is leading to a demand that the UK should leave the European Union. In Japan, the failure of the DPJ government led to the election of a Liberal Democratic Party government at the end of 2012 under Prime Minister Abe, and a resurgence of confidence on the back of his aggressive commitment to renewed fiscal and monetary stimulus, so-called Abenomics. The continuation of these policies will involve his government making difficult choices and alienating elements of their core supporters. This is happening already through participation in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will involve liberalisation of the highly protected and very, very uncompetitive agriculture sector, and with the third arrow of deregulation and business reform, which is going to involve Japanese companies adjusting their business models. For example, the extent to which they retain earnings rather than distributing them to shareholders in the form of dividends, their excessive depreciation allowances, in ways that run counter to traditional Japanese corporate practice. But Abe is going ahead with some of these policies, including the raising of consumption tax from April next year, a controversial move with which not all his supporters are comfortable. We both, therefore, have pretty radical governments inviting intrinsically conservative electorates to face radical policy options. Are there ways in which we can learn from each other? I used to give a lot of speeches on Britain Today when I was in Japan, sometimes to business audiences, sometimes to Benkyokai, sometimes to the network of Anglo-Japanese friendship societies around the country. My aim was to correct misapprehensions about modern British society and to promote a better understanding of modern British values and customs. I made a point of emphasising that modern Britain was a more diverse, less hierarchical, less deferential, more multicultural country than 50 years ago. I talked also about the way in which diversity policies on gender, on ethnicity, on disability and sexual orientation had developed. I talked also about immigration and how the vibrancy and energy of a city like London was reflected in its extraordinarily diverse population. Some aspects of this agenda and experience have begun to resonate in Japan. I was very struck when I went back to Japan after nearly 10 years away by the radical rethinking in almost every sphere of policies on disability. And politicians of all parties are now beginning to discuss the importance of bringing more women into the workforce, though it's not very clear what policies are going to be espoused that support that objective. At the same time, there are other things which obviously cause more difficulty. Immigration is identified, has been, by some politicians as an area for more radical policy debate in Japan, but there's not very much energy behind this debate, and of course, fueled by the inward-lookingness affecting a lot of Western countries in the wake of the financial crisis, the debate in the UK and other Western countries is swinging in the other direction. When I was ambassador and the DPJ was still in opposition, there was a lot of interest in what Japanese policy makers might learn from the British experience of politicians and civil servants working together. And we had a DPJ delegation coming to the UK, looking at the way the Cabinet Office worked, looking at the way select committees worked in Parliament and so forth. The DPJ's experience in this area wasn't a very happy one, but that hasn't stopped the LDP government under Prime Minister Abe from exploring setting up of a National Security Council on the British model. And discussions on this are underway. Business audiences in Japan were interested in Britain's experience on deregulation. I used to explain how the British framework had tried to get a better balance between safeguarding the consumers' interests, the workers' and the interests and so forth, while not creating a superstructure of risk avoidance that choked off all economic activity. I used to emphasise the principles of accountability and transparency and proportionateness that should lie behind effective regulation. And again, this is an area where you find a lot of Japanese businessmen arguing for a more open and radical approach, but where there's still quite a strong bias within the Japanese bureaucracy towards maintaining the status quo. By the same token, I think there are areas where Britain could learn from Japan and where we're interested in doing so. I have to add that there's an assumption that in a number of areas where Japanese track record is more impressive than ours, for example, the recent OECD survey measuring literacy and numeracy, there may be cultural factors within the educational system that are difficult to replicate. But there is a general interest in and a great admiration for Japanese social cohesiveness and stability, and a willingness at least to explore how these benefits, however much some people in Japan might see them as the reverse side of excessive social conformity and enforced collectivism, might be replicated elsewhere. I would like us to develop our dialogues in these areas, and as well as the relationship generally over the years ahead. With the Eurozone gradually recovering from the problems of the last 4 years, with the US Congress stepping back from the brink over its budget crisis, with the growth of ultra-conservative parties in a number of countries as a reaction against the economic crisis, this is not a time when we can afford to let a successful relationship like that between the UK and Japan wither. We ought to be exploring much more actively whether it could be made more load-bearing. And we also ought, in this context, I think, not to be shy about speaking our minds on developments in each other's countries we find difficult or problematical. I was struck, actually, in Japan a few weeks ago, I was back on a business trip, that I was quizzed by a number of Japanese friends about, not only about the debate about whether we were going to come out of Europe, but also about whether the recent Syria vote in the UK House of Commons, where the government's proposals on military engagement were defeated, meant that the UK was now tilting towards an isolationist position. Japanese policymakers take a very close interest in these things. By the same token, many British commentators are pleased to see the way in which Abenomics has injected a higher degree of confidence into the Japanese mood. Although a lot of the people in the media that I was talking to in Japan saw this more as a question of being loyal to the Prime Minister while he tried to make it work, rather than being confident that it actually was going to work. But there's much more concern, I think, in Britain, among British commentators, about the dangers of a resurgence of Japanese nationalism and about some of the government's ideas on constitutional reform. I think this question needs to be analysed quite carefully. And as I've indicated, there are strong reasons why I believe a degree of international military engagement by the Japanese would be a good thing, including the principle of collective self-defence and under the auspices of the UN. The adoption of a positive stance along these lines is not, in my view, incompatible with the provisions of a pacifist constitution. Indeed, the concept of positive pacifism is beginning to appear as a basic principle of the new defence orientation. But what friends of Japan worry much more about is, firstly, the resurgence of a strong nationalist sentiment on the hawkish wing of the LDP and in some of the fringe political parties like Ishinokai, betokens a more provocative stance on East Asian regional issues, and secondly, that some of the other proposed amendments that the LDP have made to the Constitution, which would elevate considerations of public order and discipline over those of human rights, and in the views of some commentators, deny the universality of human rights, represent a shift of culture away from the liberal values of the post-war settlement. It's not clear that these proposals will fly. I mean, it's not clear that they actually reflect the Japanese electorate's view in what remains a strongly consensual society, or at least a society strongly attracted to finding a consensus on difficult issues. Nor is it clear that Abe will have a parliamentary majority for all his proposals. When he was Prime Minister before, his record was reasonably pragmatic, and his immediate focus of attention is the economy, not the constitution. I think there's a very good analysis last week in the New Statesman by David Pilling of these issues. If you haven't seen it, I recommend it to you. But the banner has been raised on these issues in the LDP. The concerns that this is causing are out there. And the same considerations, of course, also apply to the questions raised by Abe earlier in the year about the government's adherence to the terms of Japan's apology for its conduct during the war made by Prime Minister Murayama. Although Abe has moderated his comments on this point more recently. Finally, my last 5 minutes, the most fundamental question of all: how well do we understand each other as countries? You might say that none of what I've described up till now, in terms of a very strong, friendly and mutually supportive, even on occasions quite affectionate relationship, would be possible if there wasn't a high degree of mutual comprehension. And there's no doubt that generations of human exchange, whether between teachers, Japanese and British business people, students, have contributed to that. There's a genuine regard in Britain, I believe, for the qualities that many people think define Japan: commitment, dedication, courtesy, respect, perhaps a degree of reticence and formality, but also, once past the initial shyness, a firm and lasting friendship. Japan features regularly and very prominently on all the polls that you see about most admired countries, and this received a dreadful injection of support after the events of 2011, when people admired so much the courage and the resilience that so many people in Japan showed in the face of that terrible disaster. And in Japan, by the same token, I was constantly being reminded by many Japanese who lived and worked in Britain what affection they had for their once adopted home. Words of one friend of mine: we feel that Britain is the country in Europe that understands us the best. But this state of affairs is not going to continue unless we work at it, and much more can still be done to engender a better understanding of the reality of Britain and Japan to Japanese and British audiences. And I should say at this point that I'm, of course, as ambassador, I was paid to accentuate the positive. I wasn't, on the whole, talking at great length about the problems that both our societies have, the problems of child poverty, the problems of unemployment, the problems of disaffected youth and so forth. Although in all these areas too, I think there's potential for us to exchange ideas about how we're tackling these problems, because they're important and we must not airbrush them out of our dialogue. I referred earlier on to the speeches I used to give about modern Britain. I did as much of this as I could, and I was trying to get the message across that Britain was no longer a country of Sherlock Holmes striding through the London fog, of Land of Hope and Glory, Ekok Shinshi, Stiff Upper Lip, this sentimental attachment to what most people in Britain now see as a very old-fashioned image of our country was very, very charming, but it could also be quite frustrating. Of course, I have to recognise there's a generational point. Many of the audiences I was talking to were of a generation for which these stereotypes were very reassuring. They had a lot of resonance, but I didn't want to be ungracious, but I did want to get the point across that that resonance is not now the same in the UK. The same is true in Britain. The image of Japan tends to be marked by cliché and stereotype, limited media exposure outside a very small number of expert magazines and newspapers. And you can see why. The unique social and business monoculture of Japan, the complexities and opacities of Japanese society and language, the tendency to infer from Japanese reticence and maybe Japan's reluctance to create a powerful external narrative for itself, to explain itself to the world, the tendency to infer from all that that Japan has become a less important and influential country than China and other faster-growing economies. All this compounds the tendency of British newspaper editors to write Japan off. We shouldn't confuse traditional and official stereotypes with the totality of transnational contact. There's a vibrant younger culture going on below the radar screen of middle-aged diplomats and newspaper editors, anime, manga, fashion, design, innovation, popular culture. In all these areas, Japan is a center of attention for younger people across Asia and in Europe as well, in architecture, in arts, crafts, cooking, many other areas of culture and lifestyle. There's a real sense of Japan as a role model and a place of pilgrimage. And we played a small part in this through the British Council. But unless we invest in the next generation of Japanese studies and higher educational partnerships between Japan and the UK, we're not going to be able to develop those future generations of students and teachers with the grounding in Japan that can take this work forward. And I do think it's important that we ensure that Japanese studies remains as interdisciplinary as possible, because there's a real danger with a nation as if I can characterise it, insular and compartmentalised as Japan, that Japanology can become a very arcane and specialised discipline. It really does need to have a breadth of academic and policy-related activity to enable these contacts to grow further. So that's why I've always argued for closer higher educational exchanges, and I'm now involved with a number of universities where this work is being taken forward. And at the same time, we're advocating renewed support for exchanges such as the JET scheme for young teachers that produce a much larger cadre of people who are committed to Japan from their earliest part of their careers. So, to conclude, because we must have time for questions, it's now nearly 70 years since the end of the Second World War. We went through a long and difficult period in our relations with Japan. Bitterness at the war experiences, followed by and coupled with resentment at Japan's economic resurgence, compounded for a time by Japanese disdain for Britain's political and economic decline. But from the 1970s, that began to change, and a strong and mutually supportive and still continuing economic and political partnership has been built over the past four decades. The challenge, I think, for the future, for us who worked in government, I'm retired from government now, but government here means a wealth of organisations committed to international activity. How do we work to expand this so that we don't take each other for granted, but that we develop these links across a wider range of activities, not just government-to-government contacts, but underpinned by a genuine understanding of what sort of peoples we are, not just a friendship grounded in sentimental stereotypes? And how do we become each other's candid friends as well as each other's strategic partners? I very much look forward to our discussion on these and other topics.
Thank you very much.